Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 15th of September. In just a few moments, Bob Schieffer will be with us. Bob Schieffer's America has just been published. It's a book of 171 of his best commentaries. They're snapshots of his thinking about money in politics. He's very concerned about that and has written a number of commentaries on money in politics. Interviews with presidents. He's interviewed every single one since, and including President Richard Nixon. The news business, why he didn't interview Paris Hilton. I'll give you a little hint there. He had no question he wanted to ask her. It's about his heroes, the effects of Katrina, advice to fathers on how to act normal, and much more. He's been at CBS News since 1969, has covered the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department, and Capitol Hill. Now the chief Washington correspondent for CBS and anchor and moderator of Face the Nation. He began his career as a reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and I didn't know this story about him. He's going to be with us just a little late. That's why I'm telling you stories. He talks about his first major encounter with history. He was working for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram when he was a very young reporter, and a woman called into the offices looking for a ride to Dallas. He said, "Lady, this is not the taxi service, and besides, the president has been shot." And she said, "Yes, I heard it on the radio. My son is the one they have arrested." So Schieffer and a fellow reporter rushed to the home of Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, and he interviewed her as they drove to Dallas. He says that he still longs for the day when someone on one side responds to someone on the other side by saying, "What an interesting point. You may be right. I'm still waiting," he says, "but I'm not holding my breath." In these essays, he tried to follow the rule laid down by his great teacher, Eric Severide, to elucidate when one can rather than advocate. The first of these commentaries appeared on Face the Nation the weekend after Richard Nixon died. He talks about lost lessons from Vietnam and from Watergate, about Jimmy Carter saying, "I will never lie to you," and thinking at the time, well, isn't that the least we should expect of our politicians? He's watched the events unfold recently in Washington, the Army cover-up of military hospital scandal, and the facts surrounding the death of former NFL star Pat Tillman, the spectacle of an attorney general who can't seem to get his story straight on anything. He talks a little bit about his growing up time, where his mother was a Yellow Dog Democrat. His brother worked in a Capitol mailroom and then for John Conley, then Governor John Conley of Texas, and was elected the youngest member of the state legislature. He, a Democrat, Bob says he fell out of love with both parties years ago and became a registered independent and once cast his ballot for Walter Cronkite. He talks about the joy of voting. I am with him on that. Voting is just so much fun. It makes you feel big and strong. He looks at the famous 1824 race, a story he'll tell us, that was thrown to the House of Representatives to decide. And he looks at the impact on politics and how every year he believes that it just gets worse, that every Congress he's covered since he came to Washington has tried some kind of reform or at least paid lip service to it, as has every administration, yet every election has cost more than the previous one. So he will talk about that as well. He talks about his favorite president. I'll let you tell him who it is. Oh, and he's on. And who has really disappointed him the most. And you can imagine who that might be. So that's Bob. And he's our guest. And you can talk to him at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And I also should tell you that he is moderating the third presidential debate, so you may want to put in his mind some questions that you think would be terrific. Hello, Bob. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be with you this morning. And you know, it's always fun to talk about your own work. So,
and
I'm happy to be here. You know, these little essays in this book they're like my little children. You know, I mean, they're my creation. And I went back when we were putting the book together and had to pick out about 170 of them from more than 700 that were written. It was sobering sometimes. I discovered some of them didn't stand the test of time. Some of them weren't really very good. But I picked out the ones that, I just picked out the ones that were my favorites and the ones I thought were still relevant. And it was a fun thing to do. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I enjoyed them so much because you come across as an extremely likable person who cares about what he does enormously. And they're very fair-minded. And perhaps most importantly to the reader, they're really interesting. They're great stories. So I loved it.
Well, thank you.
It was fun.
Thank you.
Yeah. Most of the stories, the first of the commentaries appeared the weekend after Richard Nixon died. And I would have thought, Bob, that that would be a difficult commentary to write because we had such mixed feelings. He disappointed us so greatly. But you also saw that there was some good in this man.
Well, you know, every president I've covered, some I like more than I liked others, every one of them, did manage to accomplish something, I think, rather important, including Nixon. I mean, for all the skullduggery, and he didn't, as it turned out, didn't know much about the Constitution, maybe didn't respect it very much. The fact is, his opening to China, the arms control work that he did, were very remarkable achievements, I thought. And they, too, they have really stood the test of time when you look back on it. But that weekend... And that's how I did. You're right. That's how I did start the commentaries. I just thought the broadcast that weekend needed some sort of a button. And I remarked in the closing commentary that Richard Nixon showed us that we can learn from the imperfect as well as the perfect. And the last lines of that commentary were, Richard Nixon left the White House in disgrace, but he left his life with some dignity. And to my surprise and the surprise of everybody around here, I got this enormous amount of mail, and I thought, I just couldn't believe it. We'd never gotten that much mail. And so a couple of 3 weeks later, we had a little extra time, and so I stuck another one on. And again, we got a lot of mail, and for whatever reasons, people just seem to respond to a commentary on a Sunday morning. Maybe it's because it's Sunday morning, and they're, you know, think about they're used to going to church or something. I don't know. But anyway, we made it a regular part of the broadcast. And the interesting thing to me was, is that after I started writing them, I didn't know if I had permission to do it or not, because we have, you know, kind of strict rules about expressing your opinion on CBS. And so I decided, well, you know, if the bosses don't want me to do this, they'll call and tell me to stop doing it. So I just kept doing it. Within a matter of months, I won a National Sigma Delta Chi Award for best commentary on television. The phones lit up. All
that
the bosses in New York, this is just great. Keep it up. And so I did.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk a little bit about, I love this story of what happened to you. People in the press made fun of Gerald Ford's commentary, and you say that he was your favorite president. Just, I mean, in terms of being nice, just the nicest guy. But, you know, he rushes to catch a plane and you know, he's fallen down. And then the same thing happened to you. Tell us that story. It's very funny.
Well, Gerald Ford, you're absolutely right, and we can talk about this in a minute. Of all the public officials that I ever covered, he was far and away the nicest. And we wrote all those stories about him falling down on his skis and so forth, and he became so self-conscious that he literally started running into doors. And I was covering him one day in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He was having a very successful whistle stop tour. But then he came out on the back platform of a train, and he spoke to a very nice crowd there, and it was a nice rally, but he didn't make any news, so we weren't planning to do a story on it. Then he turned around to go back in the train, and when he did, hit himself just square in the forehead on the door jamb of the train. Well, it was like a sight gag, you know, and so we had to do this story. So I went back into our local affiliate. I did the story about Gerald Ford running into yet another door, and I thought it was pretty funny at the time. And so then I ran to catch an airplane to catch up with the campaign because they'd gone on to another place. I was getting on the airplane, and just as I was turning to go into my seat, a fellow in the back said, "Hey, Bob." It was a friend of mine. I didn't know he was there. And when he said that, I was distracted, ran head first into the overhead luggage compartment, and literally knocked myself out for a couple of seconds.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I saw stars. And so... when I saw the president the next time around, I thought, well, I probably ought to tell him about it. And when I told him, he just broke out laughing, and he said, "By God, I wish I could have been there.
I'll bet he did.
So, that's just kind of the guy, kind of fellow he was and why I liked him so much.
Yeah.
He had quite a laugh.
Clinton, the most, and it must have been hard. I still think about this, having to read those star reports on television where you're talking about a certain kind of sex and, you know, give it my prudish kind of upbringing. But I was cringing when reporters were doing that. And I know from reading your essays that you had a hard time, too, that, you know, we were in a mess here and nobody came out very well as a result of this, even news people who had to read these steamy reports on television.
You know, that was the story that, of all the stories I've covered, the Monica Lewinsky scandal was the one I found most distasteful and the one I was most uncomfortable about. And I tell you something else. It really changed our culture in a funny kind of way. I remember, I will never forget, the afternoon when the Star report came out, and we got a little scoop on it. We got a under-the-table copy from a member of Congress who let us have it first. And people were, you know, we were reading this thing page by page. Mm-hmm. I was on live television, and I remember reading along at one point, and I said, and then he put his hand, and then he put his hand, and I said, Dan, I'm going to have to stop here for a minute. I was talking to Dan Rather at the other end, who was at news headquarters anchoring. I said, I need to read this over here to make sure I'm not going to say something that I shouldn't say. And I said, and then they had sex of a kind. I had never, ever heard that term before. I didn't know what it meant. I don't know where it came from in the back of my mind. But I didn't know, and I had never said on television, I probably hadn't said in Mixed Company, used the term oral sex.
Right.
And so I said that. But, you know, after that, you know, people started kind of using those terms, and it became a problem for parents talking to their kids about things like this.
Yes.
It really did kind of coarsen our culture, I think, and that's what I found so distasteful about it. But, you know, I'll tell you something else. Most of the time when you're covering a big story, when it's over, it's kind of traditional. Reporters all gather at the nearest bar and tell all the war stories and stuff. I remember when that one was over, we all kind of adjourned to the place next door to the CBS Bureau. And we were just glad it was over.
I'm sure you were.
You know, it was kind of like you kind of wanted to go take a shower.
Yeah, right,
and,
exactly.
It was unlike any story that I have covered before or since. And as you know, I've been around a couple of big stories in my time. But that was the one that I found least rewarding.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, you don't want to run across another one like this anytime soon.
No, I just don't have any more of those.
Yeah. And yet you thought that that Clinton had great promise, a very, very gifted politician who could connect with people. He disappointed you on some levels.
He really did, probably more than any other politician I've known because, you know, I come from Texas. I kind of like it when somebody who's not from the Northeast, which a lot of people in the Northeast somehow believe is where all wisdom comes from. Obviously, I don't believe that, and you don't. So I'm kind of happy when somebody from another part of the country comes forward. I thought he had such promise. I thought he had political skills, probably the best of any politician I had known about since back when Melvin Laird, who was a great politician, was Secretary of Defense, and I covered him, and maybe all the way back to Lyndon Johnson, who probably I thought knew more about how to make the government work than any other single politician that I'd covered. And yet, Clinton managed to just sort of fritter that away, and for whatever the reasons, he did disappoint me greatly.
Mm-hmm. And many Americans. You talk, and I want you to spend a little bit of time, because I feel just the same way, the joy of voting. You talk about fairly famous colleagues who have disclosed they no longer vote so they can be neutral as journalists, but you don't get what they're saying because it's something you got to do just like you pay a water bill, and also voting is so much fun. I'm with you. It is fun.
And you know why it's fun? Because we can vote for somebody or against somebody for any reason that we choose. You know, when I write a news story, when you hold a discussion, we try to base it on fact. We have to have a reason for doing what we do, for taking the position or writing something. When you vote, you don't have to have a reason. You may not like the way a person parts their hair. If that's how you feel about it, you're welcome to vote against them for that reason. On the other hand, if you really like them, if it's somebody you admire, then you can vote for them for that reason. But I just think it's something that as a citizen we ought to do, and I've always found more fun than anything in the world. My mother used to say, go vote. It'll make you feel big and strong. And I think it does. I really think it does. And I always try to vote. Only once in a presidential election did I find that I disliked both candidates to the point that I wrote in Walter Cronkite's name that year.
I know.
I always, I always vote for somebody. And I'll tell you something else. I don't ever tell anybody who I vote for. That's another good thing about voting. You can tell everybody, or you don't have to tell anyone. I don't tell my wife because she's afraid I'll always make the wrong decision. She, you know. So we never tell who we vote.
Yeah. And Walter Cronkite probably could have been president. What do you think, Bob?
Well, you know, it now comes to light that George McGovern at one point seriously thought of asking Walter Cronkite to be on the ticket. I don't know if that would have made any difference, but we now know that Walter says, and he was, you know, in his late 80s when he finally confirmed it, he said if George McGovern had asked him, he would have run with him.
And really?
I always wonder how, if that election would have come out any differently. I'm not really sure that it would, but, you know, I'll tell you what probably would have happened. McGovern might have carried a state or two, and he would have been the leading candidate to run the next time around. And as you'll remember, after he went through what he went through with having to take Eagleton off the ticket, put right. Sarge Shriver on, it pretty much wiped him out. And after that, the next year, Jimmy Carter, who was a total unknown, got the Democratic nomination. In fact, McGovern told me himself one time, he thought if it had not been for the Eagleton affair, he said, I don't think I'd have beat Nixon, but I do think I would have been the leading Democrat to get the nomination the next time around. And because he said he thought he would have carried at least a couple of states.
That's interesting.
So yeah. Who knows?
Who knows? One of the essays, I can't remember when this was written, but I wonder what your thoughts are about it now. It's just a couple years old, I think. All last week, you say, I was thinking, what if someone from another planet came here and all he knew about our elections was what he learned from campaign commercials?
Yeah. I mean, think about it. If all you knew is what you see in these commercials, you would think the only people who seek public office are liars, thieves, adulterers.
Right.
You would think that normal people didn't seek the presidency. And I think that's one of the things that's gone so haywire about our politics now. You know, when I was a little boy, my grandmother was convinced I would grow up to be president. Now, I didn't. But that's what all grandmothers thought about their grandsons. That someday he'll be president. Now, you seldom hear anyone say, I hope my child grows up to be a politician, mm-hmm. let alone run for president. And that's what these nasty, awful campaign commercials have done to our national psyche and what they've done to our politics in general. We've got to find a better way than the way we're doing it now.
And I know you've written so many essays on money and politics, and as you write, every six-year-old would know if you're invited to a $1,000 a plate breakfast for somebody, and then they're voting on a piece of legislation related to what your profession is that day, you don't think they want something? They didn't just want it for the bacon and eggs?
Well, exactly. You know, the problem is that, and we talk about this, is that the government is just not working very well anymore. The Congress cannot confront the major issues of the day. It spends most of its time just nibbling around the edges. I believe the main reason for that is that a politician has to raise so much money before he gets to Washington. He has to sign off with so many special interest groups before he gets here that once here, his positions are set in stone. He cannot compromise. If a legislative body can't compromise, then it ceases to function, and it sinks into this kind of gridlock that has now become the norm rather than the exception. And I think it all goes back to the way we send people to Washington these days, and we simply have to find some way that money is not the overriding factor in every campaign. We're en route to having our first $2 billion presidential campaign. Now, that's fine. And, I mean, you know, both sides say, look, that's how we get people involved. But if you can tell me that the level of candidates that our system is turning out these days is somehow better than the candidates that we had, that were, you know, the people who were the candidates in days gone by, I'll be glad to listen to it. But I think it's pretty hard to make that argument. I think we had candidates that were just as good or maybe better when it didn't cost nearly as much.
Bob Schieffer is our guest. We're happy to have him with us this hour. His book is America, and it's a series of 171 essays. Actually, he's written many more than that, but 171 of the best of his commentaries, thinking about money and politics, interviews with presidents, the news business, why he didn't interview Paris Hilton, his heroes, the effects of Katrina. He's a father, so it's advice to fathers on how to act normal and about the honorable news profession as well. We'll spend some time talking about that as it has been blasted in this particular election cycle. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bob Schieffer, our guest this hour, his book is Bob Schieffer's America, which has just been published by Putnam, and a series of really thoughtful, he's a heck of a writer, too, and has this wisdom which comes from many years of covering Washington. He started doing commentaries after Richard Nixon's resignation. So let's go to some phone calls. Chris from Glendale, hi.
Hi. As you know, CBS television covered the six successful lunar landings during 1969, 1971, 1972. Question for Mr. Schieffer. What did you notice at CBS about the lunar landings or about CBS news operations that was interesting and never got into the historical record?
Well, you know, the lunar landings, it's an interesting question. The one big story that I never covered in all my years at CBS, and I'm getting on to being there 40 years, was the space program. I don't know why, but somehow I was never a part of that. It was Walter Cronkite's favorite story. Mm-hmm. He would tell you today that it is still his favorite story, and it was a big story. But my only connection to it was in the 1988 campaign when George Bush, the first George Bush, went out as vice president to greet the astronauts who are coming back in the space shuttle. We were out at Edwards Air Force Base, and it was a great thrill to see that aircraft, spacecraft, land out there, and the president presented them with an American flag, and it just made me wish. I have very few regrets. I mean, I've had such a great opportunity to cover so many things. It just made me wish I could have been a part of the space program, but, you know, it's just one of those things. I was never assigned to cover it, but they were terrific stories to cover, and what was so good about them as news stories is it was positive. Mm-hmm. You were reporting on something that was good, something that had happened, something where we'd gone where, as they used to say on Star Trek, where people had never gone before, and all of that. So much of the news that we cover, by definition, is bad news because, as Walter himself once said, you know, it's not a news story when your cat stays home, but it's a big story in the neighborhood when somebody's cat runs off. So that's one definition of news. Those were, I mean, they just took your breath away when they happened. And I, as I say, it's my one regret that I never really got to cover that in much detail.
Oh, you've done your fair share, though, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
So it's okay.
Let me tell you something. I have, you know, if my life ended tomorrow, I wouldn't feel shortchanged. I'd have had an opportunity to do what I wanted to do as
right.
a kid. And, you know, and see things that I never thought I'd ever get to see and talk to people I never thought I'd interview. So I have no regrets, but I do kind of wish I'd have gotten a chance to cover space.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. This is in your other book, I know, but I had never heard this story. This just in, I was reading about you over the weekend. And tell me this, you were working for the Fort Worth paper. You get a phone call.
Yeah.
The day that Kennedy has been shot, a woman calls the offices of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram.
Yeah.
And you answered the phone. And tell us the story. It is so remarkable.
It is the first thing that I always tell kids when I give a lecture in journalism schools is answer the phone. I'm working there just trying to help out. I was the police reporter at the paper in those days, but I'd just gone into the city desk early when we heard the president had been shot, and I was just trying to get my hand on the city desk answering the phones. I pick up a phone, and a woman said, "Is there anyone there who can give me a ride to Dallas?" And I said, "Well, lady, you know, we don't run the taxi service here, and besides, the president's been shot." And she said, "Yes, I heard it on the radio. I think my son is the one they've arrested." And it was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Oh, my
mother.
Gosh.
Another reporter and I went out to the address she gave us. We put aside that request about not running a taxi service.
Right, I'll bet.
She was waiting on the curb when we got there. We drove her to Dallas. I interviewed her on the way. First time she talked to reporters and didn't talk to anyone else for about 3 weeks. So it was a big scoop for me. But the most unbelievable part was that once we got there, in those days, we never told people who we were. If they asked us, we told them. But if they thought we were detectives, we let them think that, which is why I always wore a snap-brim hat so I'd look like Dick Tracy. But we got there. I told one of the uniformed cops, I said, I'm the one that brought Oswald's mother over here. I said, is there any place we can put her where the these reporters won't be bothering her? And so they found a little office in the burglary squad. I took her back in there. And the great thing about it, there was a phone there. So I could go out in the hall, gather up information, and then go back and had a phone to phone it in, which was very important in those days. Toward dark, she said, "Do you think they'd let me talk to my son?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." So I went to the chief of homicide and said she'd like to see her son. He said, "Well, we probably ought to do that." They took us into a holding room off the jail. Mind you, I'd been there 4 hours. Nobody had asked me who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to bring him down from the jail cell. And I'm thinking, oh, my heavens, I'm going to get to, you know, hear this man talk to his mother. Maybe I'll get to interview him. Who knows where this goes? Finally, a guy standing in the corner said, "Who are you?" Well, it turned out it was an FBI agent doing what he was supposed to do. He was the first person that asked me who I was, and when I told him I was a reporter, the short version of what he said was, "Get out of here, because if I ever see you again, I'm going to kill you."
Oh, my gosh.
He actually said that. They were just furious. So I quickly excused myself, and the story ends there, but I always call it the biggest story I almost got but didn't.
But, yeah, but you did. You got part
adventure.
Of it. What an adventure is right. Answer the phone.
Say, should I be a reporter? I just tell them that story. Where else could you have that kind of an
you
experience
got it.
In the midst of a tragedy?
Right,
like
right. Let's go to Tim from Watertown. Hi, Tim.
Hello,
Tim.
I would like to ask you why you considered Erich Severide such the smartest man you ever encountered. You mentioned it in your earlier book, Justice In. The reason why I would like to know it is because he commented on his commentary in the 70s on a letter I wrote to CBS where I was critical of the media.
Uh-huh.
And I think he would like to say what he wanted to say, but naturally couldn't say it. But I would like to know that. Plus, if you want to know who is calling, I suggest that you buy the book Apathy and the Media, because I was quite a thorn in the side of CBS News in the 70s, and it is on Amazon now. You can still purchase it. Thank you.
Okay, well, I will tell you why. I thought Eric was one of the wisest and bravest men that I had ever known. He was just sort of above the rest of us. He was an original thinker. He was a great patriot. He'd been a war correspondent in World War II. And I always, what I liked about Eric was he said, our role is not to persuade, but to elucidate. In other words, to explain complicated issues. And I always thought that he did a very good job of that. And I was very honored when I returned to Washington after the year and a half that I did the Evening News that I was... assigned the office that used to be Eric Severide's office. So he was simply one of my heroes. Did I always agree with the conclusions he came to? No, and I don't think anyone who does commentary or does opinion pieces expects that, and I certainly don't. I try to persuade, not to convince. I'm not trying to convince anybody that what I'm saying is absolutely right, because it may not be. But what I'm happy about is when people say, that's a very interesting take. I never really thought of it in that way. So that would be why I really admire Eric Severide.
And in this time when we're debating how smart we want our presidential candidates, he was a very erudite man and extremely popular. So we want our commentators smart, at least, right?
I thought he was very smart.
Yeah, I would agree. So you're doing the third debate?
Yes.
Are you preparing for it now?
I am.
Are you?
I mean, every day, and I'm an old-fashioned kind of preparer. You know, I have a young assistant who's 22 years old. She reads the newspapers online. She saves things online. She does everything electronically. Right. I'm still a guy. I still got some scissors, and I still clip things out of the newspapers, and I make my little files, and I talk to people. And every time I go out to talk to an audience or to talk about my book, I try to ask, what do you think I ought to ask in that debate? And you'd be surprised. People are serious. People are smart. And so I really learn from them. So while I'm out kind of talking about my book over this next week, I'll be asking people and I'll be collecting information. And in a funny kind of way, the people I talk to, they sort of become my focus groups. I find out what's on people's mind, just like, on this broadcast.
Right. And a good portion of the third debate, as I understand it, is the economy, isn't it? And you're going to have so much material.
We will do domestic matters. And let me just say, if I can, just do a little commercial for these debates. Mm-hmm. I think that they're going to be more crucial than ever and may well be the deciding factor in who wins this election. The good news is they will be real debates this time. We have gotten both candidates, and nobody's ever agreed to this before, to let us have a freewheeling debate.
Great.
in the classic sense. We'll divide each debate into nine-minute segments. I'll pose a question at the beginning of each segment. My debate's on domestic policy. Jim Lehrer's doing the one on foreign policy, which will be first. I'll pose a question, give each of them a chance to answer that question, and then my job will be to encourage them to ask the follow-up questions.
Great.
Of each other. We've never done that before. If it works, it's not only going to be entertaining, I think it will be enlightening. I think we'll get a real sense of who these people are. That, I'll consider it successful if I open with a question for the first segment and you don't hear from me until I say, okay, time's up, let's go on. Segment two. We'll see. If they don't ask good, sharp questions, if they sort of get off track, I'll try to steer them onto track. But it's going to be about them. It won't be about the moderator.
And you're bound to have, Bob, a huge audience, aren't you?
Oh, my heavens. It's scary. I did a debate. I did the final debate in 2004 between Kerry and Bush. And I'll never forget. Standing backstage before I went on, people sometimes ask me, do you get nervous being on television? And the true answer is no. I've done it so long, it's like professional sports. You learn to play the game, then you learn to play in front of people, and you just don't get nervous. But that night, standing backstage, I really got butterflies because I'm thinking to myself, this may decide this election.
Oh.
And then I thought, I'm just the umpire here. They're the ones that ought to be nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I walked out on stage. And, when the red light went on, my training and professionalism kicked in, and it wasn't a problem. But I really did. I had just kind of a tingly feeling before I went on. And,
yeah.
I really enjoy doing them. And
I'm sure.
I'm really looking forward to this one.
Right. Well, you also bring, and I so appreciate that so much, wisdom to it and experience in covering this, so you can remember other campaigns, you remember other issues, you bring a sense of history to this, which we need. I think we need it.
Well, these debates, they're kind of uniquely American. And, they didn't start. We always think back to presidential debates, and people talk about Lincoln and Douglas, but they were running for the Senate when they debated. Mm-hmm. It was not about a presidential debate. And then I guess it was one way back there, Hoover or somebody, I don't know. But it was not until John Kennedy and Richard Nixon debated that we began to have these on a regular basis. And they're fairly modern, a fairly modern innovation. But I found every one of them interesting, whether it was Reagan and Mondale or Ford and Carter. They all become very, very important. And I think this time around will be more decisive than ever, quite frankly.
All right, so Bob's got a big role here in this presidential election. If you want to help him out, let him know what's on your mind as they look at domestic issues and particularly the economy. So help him think about what he ought to be asking during that debate. Zach from Green Bay, hi.
Good morning. I very much appreciate this opportunity. I just wanted to say that during my lifetime, I have observed and experienced really the steady and now alarming decline of the economic stability of the working class and the true middle class in this family, in this country. And in particular, the aspect that I want to ask about is the ongoing health care crisis, where we have 40 to 50 million working people without coverage, and we have the inability to pay for medical bills being the number one or number two reason that people have to declare bankruptcy in this country. And I just feel that this issue in general has been largely ignored by the media.
You know, I really take your point, and I plead guilty to that. I don't think we've done nearly enough on health care. But I want to assure you that will be one of the first things that I'm going to ask these candidates about when we get to the debates. We have simply got to do better than we're doing on this front. John McCain and Barack Obama have two very different approaches to health care, and I'm going to try to pin them down as much as I can on where do we go from here on this. I've never talked to anybody, maybe you have, but I hadn't talked to anybody yet who is satisfied with the health care situation in this country. And I think we've got to do better, and I think you're right. I think that we in the media have not devoted enough attention to it because it is so enormously complicated. You know, reporters can't report on things they don't understand, and I think too many times, and I'm as guilty as the others of this, I really don't know as much about this as I should, but I think we've got to put it right up on the front burner, and both these candidates are talking about they want to change it, and we'll make sure that we get a good idea in that debate of exactly what they intend to do. And thank you very much for your question.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Let's pause for a moment. Bob Schieffer is our guest. His book is Bob Schieffer's America, a collection of 171 of his commentaries covering all kinds of issues. And he is going to be, as we've been talking about just recently, moderating the third presidential debate, October 15, and the topics will be domestic and economic policy. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now for Bob Schieffer, and we go next to Tom from Rhinelander. Hi, Tom.
How you doing, Kathleen?
Fine. How are you?
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for having the show, and I'd like to just say first that I've always had a great deal of admiration and respect for Bob Schieffer and the city of Edmont.
Thank you very much.
One of the I have just a couple of points I'd like to make and ask about. Let me start with the third, actually, and ask, why has there been no media outrage at the fact that this Palin woman is totally unavailable to provide information, therefore, to the country when she stands to possibly be the...
Well, I think there, I wouldn't know that, I wouldn't say that I call it outrage, but I would just say that we're doing everything we can to get her on Face the Nation, to get her on CBS. I would also say that I do not believe that it is a good strategy to just keep her hidden away. Now, she's done the one interview with Charlie Gibson. I also, we hear from the McCain people sometimes that maybe the media is trying to set up a double standard, that maybe they've been unfair to her. But I would say I find it somewhat demeaning that they're not letting her get out and talk to the press and hold news conferences. I do not think that this can continue, and I do not think it is a what will be a successful campaign strategy. People are not going to accept that, because you are absolutely right. We've had 43 presidents. 9 of them have been accidental presidents. 4 of them replaced presidents who died in office. 4 of them replaced presidents who'd been assassinated. 1 of them replaced Richard Nixon, who, of course, resigned. Now, that is more than 20% of our presidents. The American people, it's not something about the press, what we deserve. It's what the American people deserve. They deserve to know all about the people who could become president. And I actually think you're going to see more of her in the days to come. I think they're just sort of regrouping and sort of planning how they're going to do it from here on in. But I think she's going to have to come out and talk to people and discuss every aspect of her life and who she is and how she feels about mm-hmm. things. Because we just don't know much about her.
I know you just said you've been trying to get her for Face the Nation. What response have you been receiving?
Well, I had John McCain on, not Sunday, but Sunday before that.
Right.
And he said on the air, I said, when are you going to let her out, Senator McCain? And he said, she'll start doing interviews in the coming week. Well, she did do Charlie Gibson, of course, at ABC, and said, I'm going to encourage her to come on Face the Nation, and kind of grinned. And I said, well, thank you very much. And at the end of the broadcast, I said, and Senator McCain, thanks, and we'll look forward to having Sarah Palin next Sunday on Face the Nation. Well, she didn't quite make that deadline, but I think we'll get her.
I have a couple other questions.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I'd like to follow up with the first is, and I can take the answers off the air. But the first is, why is there such a lack of investigative and journalism now, and of factual analysis of what the media is given, for example, by the administration? And let me amplify on that just by saying that, for example, the use of language. I hear CNN and the regular networks and everybody else, you know, frequently when they're giving a short review of what's going on, they talk about Operation Iraqi Freedom. They don't say the invasion of Iraq or anything. They take the administration's distorted view of what this is about and use it, and words matter. So they're actually, you know, using the media to communicate information that's helpful to them. Another example is this Maverick thing, constantly calling a guy who is 90% goose-stepped with his party, a party that allows for almost no dissension, being called a Maverick? Are you kidding me?
Well, I would have to take a little exception to the premise of your question. I think it's fair to say that there's been plenty of criticism of the invasion of Iraq, and I don't think the media has been bashful about that. I will admit, in the beginning, I think probably all of us in retrospect feel that we should have asked harder questions and should have been more skeptical in the very beginning. But I think there's been plenty of criticism on that. As far as John McCain is a maverick. He has taken on the administration on some things. He was one of the earliest critics of the policy in Iraq. The other part of it is, and you're finding out from the Democrats, and I think that plenty of people are going to know that he also voted with the Bush administration a great deal of the time. But that's what this election is all about. I think we've done a pretty good job of laying out who both of these candidates are. So I take your point, but I don't entirely agree with you that we haven't been hard enough on it.
Mm-hmm. You write in one of your pieces about Jimmy Carter saying, I will never lie to you, thinking at the time, well, isn't that the least we should expect of our politicians?
And up until that point, it was, of course, Kathleen. But, you know, coming after Richard Nixon, that proved to be a slogan that was strong enough that it that I think it got Jimmy Carter elected.
Mm-hmm. And then you also write about the Army's cover-ups of the military hospital scandal. That was such a horrendous story. It brought tears to your eyes. The facts surrounding the death of former NFL star Pat Tillman,
yeah,
the attorney general who couldn't get his story straight.
Yeah.
And you wondered, and do you still wonder this, does anyone in a position of power remember what happened in those days after Vietnam and Watergate? And you were there, so you can speak about it with some authority.
Well, and what I said was, you know, when the government gets caught telling lies, when the government gets caught misrepresenting something the way it is, it always comes back to bite them.
Mm.
And, you know, we can't talk about having a free press. We can't talk about those kinds of things unless we practice what we preach. And that's one of the things that I do talk about in the book. The great strength of America is not just our weapons. The weapons kept the Soviet Union at bay during the Cold War. But what won the Cold War was when the people in the East looked west, and there are no secrets anymore because of television, and realized there was a better way of life on the other side of the Iron Curtain, and that's what caused it to collapse. But our values, we have to practice them as well as advertise them, and that's why we, you know, we have to be so careful. I mean, you can't say you're for a free press when you're out there trying to bribe the press. That's just not going to work, and it's going to destroy your credibility. But I just go back to, if we practice what we preach and we understand that our values are what keep us strong, in the long run, we'll be all right. But sometimes in the short run, I'm afraid we forget that.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Sarah from La Crosse. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Sarah.
Well, I'm really excited because I wrote an email to your boss at CBS News one time, and he forwarded it to you, and you said, you wrote back to me and said, Sarah, you made my day. I said, so many wonderful things. I wanted you to stay on CBS News. I commented about what a wonderful book you wrote, and I bought copies of that book, this just in, and sent to friends. It's just a wonderful book, and
well,
the stories.
Well, I tell you, Sarah, not to do a commercial for my own book, but that's sort of why I'm here, I guess.
Now, there's honesty.
Full disclosure here. If you like this just in, I think you will really like the new one, which is the collection of the commentaries I do at the end of the broadcast. And I want to emphasize again, and anybody who knows and watches Face the Nation knows it, I'm not trying to persuade anybody to my point of view. I'm just trying to provoke thought, and when I get people to say, gosh, that's an interesting way to look at it, that really makes me happy. It also, if I can give people a little chuckle, and a lot of these are sort of lighthearted, our news is so grim. I'm like people sitting there watching television. I get tired of all this bad news, too. And if I can make, leave people a little smile, I think that's great. I really love that. So thank you for saying such nice things, Sarah.
And you know what I love is that you didn't interview Paris Hilton because you didn't know what you would ask her. I'm with you.
Remember that when, you know, news organizations were writing these letters and saying, you know, trying to get her, and then Larry King got her for the first interview, and Larry's a friend of mine, but they put it on the front page of the New York Times.
Mm.
They thought it was such a big news story, and I in my little essay, I confessed I didn't call her and try to get her for Face the Nation because I couldn't think of a single thing she said that I wanted to ask her about. But, you know, I must say, when she did that little commercial after the McCain people did the thing, the commercial about her and had her, and when she did the thing calling John McCain an old white-haired dude and so forth, I thought that was pretty funny.
It was funny.
I really got a kick out of that.
One final call, Boyd from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and hi, Mr. Schaefer. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Just one question. I'll make this brief, and I asked this to Neil Conan when I had the chance to meet him in Madison a few months ago. Just in a nutshell, what can you remember? What were you doing on the days on when President Kennedy was shot and on September 11th?
Well, he already talked about the Kennedy thing, so.
Okay.
I was working at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and I told the story a little earlier in the day. I was sort of an asterisk to that story because I actually took Lee Harvey Oswald's mother over to Dallas. She had called the newspaper looking for a ride. So you're right. I will never, ever forget that day, but I will never, ever forget 9/11. You know, we as reporters are trained to report stories about other people, but this one was about us. It was our families that were at risk. My brother had been in the Pentagon on the Friday before that attack, in the very room where that plane hit. Had they chosen to do it on Friday instead of Tuesday, he would have been killed. Every single person in New York that worked for CBS News who went to Ground Zero had a near-death experience. Mm. The director, Eric Shapiro, who directed the first hours of our coverage, did so thinking his own daughter had been killed.
Oh,
I mean,
my God.
These are things. I knew 11 people who were killed on 9/11. I was headed up to the Capitol when my bureau chief called me on the phone and said, get out of there. We think there's another plane headed for Washington. We think it's headed for the Capitol building. That was the one that those passengers in Pennsylvania forced down. So you're right. I can remember every moment of those 2 days, and I'll never forget either one.
No, I'm sure you won't. Well, you're great. Thanks so much for the book. It's just, I really loved reading it. It was good.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, and you're an honor to your profession, which is an honorable profession. We can end on that, right?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a real pleasure to be with you and with your viewers and listeners this morning.
Thanks. Bob Schieffer, and the book is Bob Schieffer's America. It has just been published by Putnam. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock when we'll talk about grabbing issues of the day. So stay with us. News ahead from National Public Radio here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.